Good morning. This weekend, people getting health insurance through federal marketplaces will see their average monthly prices go up a lot. Will they get sticker shock and decide to skip insurance altogether? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Federal shutdown is threatening access to childcare and schooling for 65,000 infants and preschoolers. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Amy Martinez. Without federal funding, many Head Start centers will have to close next month. Also, President Trump's pick for Surgeon General faces the Senate, and California farmers say the Republican congressman understands them and they don't want a Democratic redistricting plan that could change that. It's Thursday, October 30th. On this day in 1974, Muhammad Ali knocked out George Foreman in the Rumble in the Jungle. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Trump is flying back to Washington after his meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping. Writing online, Trump said they had a, quote, truly great meeting. He says China will start buying American farm products and may start the process of buying American oil and gas. NPR's Deepa Shivaram reports on Trump's comment about the next trade step.
Trump says he and Xi came to an agreement on a trade deal, but it hasn't been finalized just yet.
It was an outstanding group of decisions, I think, that was made. A lot of decisions were made, too. There wasn't too much left out there.
The U.S. will lower tariffs on China from 57% to 47% because of Xi's commitment to reduce the flow of fentanyl, Trump says. China will also start repurchasing soybeans from the U.S. and stop the recent limit on rare earths exports that was announced a few weeks ago. Trump says he will visit China next April and Xi will come to the U.S. after that. Deepa Shivaram, NPR News, Gyeongju, Korea.
It's been a month since the federal government shut down. Federal programs at risk include food assistance to millions of Americans. Now, lawmakers in both parties warn that millions of needy Americans who get funding to help pay their heating bills could have trouble getting those funds as cold weather sets in. President Trump's pick to be the next U.S. Surgeon General is scheduled to appear for her confirmation hearing later this morning. Casey Means is an entrepreneur and wellness influencer. She was tapped for the job after Trump's first nominee withdrew. NPR's Will Stone has more.
Casey Means gained popularity after publishing a book on diet and metabolic health. She attended Stanford Medical School, but never completed her medical training to become a head and neck surgeon. She founded a company that promotes devices to monitor your blood sugar and has ties to the supplement industry. She's an ally of Secretary of Health Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and his broader Make America Healthy Again platform. Critics of her nomination point to her lack of clinical and leadership experience and raise concerns about some of her views, including on the childhood vaccine schedule. Means will appear before the Senate committee in a virtual hearing. Will Stone, NPR News.
Hurricane Melissa is still a Category 2 storm with top sustained winds of 105 miles per hour. It is moving away from Cuba after roaring over that island yesterday. Melissa smashed into Jamaica on Tuesday. Reporter Nick Davis is in central Jamaica where recovery is just starting.
The storm made its way up over the mountains here. Buildings which were made of solid concrete breeze block, the cinder block buildings have done absolutely okay. But in the sort of communities, the more agricultural communities, literally on the other side of the hill, that's where things have got a little bit more precarious.
Nick Davis reporting from central Jamaica. On Wall Street in pre-market trading, Dow futures are lower. It's NPR. The newly merged entertainment company, Paramount Skydance, is going to lay off about 2,000 workers. The company says it'll cut its workforce by about 10% as part of a reorganization. The first layoffs target staffers at CBS News. The morning and evening streaming shows have been canceled. Texas authorities say a fire that started in a cotton gin has spread to about 14 acres. About half of the fire is contained. Thick smoke is blanketing the southern Texas town of Gregory. It's on the Gulf Coast, just north of Corpus Christi. Several people have been told to evacuate. The Toronto Blue Jays beat the Los Angeles Dodgers last night in L.A. in Game 5 of the World Series. They've now taken a 3-2 lead in the series. Steve Futterman has more from Dodger Stadium in L.A.
The Toronto Blue Jays are one game away from winning the World Series after a 6-1 win here in Game 5. The Blue Jays took a 1-0 lead on the very first pitch. Davis Schneider hit the ball over the left field fence. Then the very next batter, Vladimir Guerrero Jr., did the same thing. After just three pitches, it was 2-0 Toronto. The first time in World Series history, the first two batters have hit home runs. The other part of the Game 5 story was the pitching of 22-year-old Toronto rookie Trey Yesavage. He held the Dodgers to one run on three hits in seven innings. He struck out 12, a World Series record for a rookie. The series resumes on Friday in Toronto. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman at the World Series in Los Angeles.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping those in need is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. This is NPR.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 seconds.
Any questions?
Where's the scariest place you've ever been?
Scariest place I've ever been? Maybe St. Cloud, Minnesota, where the crazed war widow threw her baby down a well. I mean, it's thick.
That's a segment from the film 1408, based off a Stephen King short story. Who knew St. Cloud was such a fright? Certainly not St. Cloud. The story seems to have popped from the imagination of the screenwriter. However, the cast of Travel Channel's Ghost Hunters did roll into nearby Sauk Center to investigate the Palmer House.
Some of these experiences that not only you yourself are having, but a lot of other people are all kind of dark-natured.
I feel surrounded. I feel...
Whoa.
Built early in the 20th century, the hotel has been attracting paranormal investigators and ghostly tenants. For years.
We felt you. We documented your presence. Can you show us who you are?
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
I'm Layla Faldin.
And I'm A. Martinez. Millions of Americans will be able to start shopping for health insurance on Saturday, and some of them might not like what they'll see. The average monthly premiums for the roughly 24 million people who get their coverage through the Affordable Care Act marketplaces are expected to more than double. That's unless Congress extends subsidies that have been helping people pay for coverage. They were created in 2021 during the pandemic and eventually extended through this year. Democrats are hoping that people seeing much higher rates and then being vocal about them will convince Republicans to extend the subsidies quickly. Now, that standoff is what's behind the current government shutdown. Coming up, we'll talk to one of the architects of the Affordable Care Act about why the law was passed in the first place and what issues he sees with the ACA that still need to be fixed. But we'll start with the changes this weekend. Sarah Bowden is a health reporter in Pittsburgh. She's been following this. So, Sarah, the predictions are that the average premium is going to more than double. Do we know who might be hit the hardest?
So it really depends on where you live and how much you earn. For people who earn more than 400% of the federal poverty level, they're likely to see the biggest jumps. For example, let's say you and your spouse, you're both 60 years old and bring in a combined $85,000 a year, which is just over that 400% threshold. That means their subsidies will disappear in 2026 if nothing changes. This past year, a couple like that paid $600 a month for mid-level coverage, which is like known as the Silver Plan. Without the subsidies, that price tag shoots way up. The health policy think tank KFF did an analysis. It shows that if that couple lives in Pittsburgh, their premium will increase to more than $2,000 a month starting next year.
Okay, sounds like pretty big jumps. Is that going to be the way it's going to be everywhere? It's going to be high everywhere.
In some places, it's going to be even higher. Health insurance rates vary by location, and these subsidies won't be there to help. So, for example, if that same couple lived in Wheeling, West Virginia, which is just an hour from Pittsburgh, KFF estimates that a silver plan will cost them $4,200 come January.
A month?
Hello?
A month? Yeah, was that number a month?
Yes, it's a
okay,
month.
Okay.
And rates are going to go up for people who have lower incomes as well. These subsidies also help them. Now, the price increases may not be as extreme, but they will feel it in their wallets.
Do you think people will pay this much to get health care coverage?
Yeah, so a lot of Americans are waiting to see their final rates. I spoke with Devin Trolley. She's the head of the insurance market here in Pennsylvania, and she's worried that people won't renew their coverage.
With these higher prices, what we'll really be looking at is how many of our current enrollees are making the difficult decision to drop coverage, and are we getting any new enrollees in, or are they really pushed away by the cost as well?
So, Sarah, I mean, how long will we have to wait to see whether people are signing up?
Trolley says that in her experience, people who already have coverage for the marketplace tend to sign up at the start of open enrollment. These are folks who will be most aware of premium increases because they can compare their new 2026 rates to what they currently pay. So I'm guessing we'll hear pretty soon from folks if they're upset about the prices or have sticker shock. We're talking about real estate agents, manicurists, farmers. KFF found these people that they're going to be more likely to be self-employed and to rely on insurance from the marketplace. It's going to be interesting to see how members of Congress react, and I'll be watching to see if they change their positions on ACA subsidies and if this might break the stalemate in Congress and end the government shutdown.
All right, that's reporter Sarah Bowden in Pittsburgh. Thank you for talking through the subsidies with us.
My pleasure.
Democrats argue that without these subsidies, the cost to buy these policies is going to skyrocket. Republicans say the Affordable Care Act isn't doing anything about runaway health costs, but they insist they will talk about this once Democrats agree to support the Republican spending bill. But that invites the question of why so many people need a subsidy from the government to afford health insurance to begin with. And is this really the best way to get health care to people who didn't already have access to it? So we're calling somebody who was there at the creation. That's Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel. He is an oncologist, an authority on bioethics, and vice provost for global initiatives at the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine. And he is considered one of the architects of the ACA. And he's with us now. Good morning, doctor. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's my great pleasure to be with you.
So a lot of people get health insurance through their employers. We've had Medicare, which helps pay for health care for seniors. We have Medicaid, which helps pay for health care for people with very low incomes. What was the problem the ACA was intended to solve?
Well, the problem was about 45 million uninsured Americans, many of them working at relatively low-paying jobs where the employer could not afford to offer health insurance, some of them disabled, some of them just out of the system or not understanding how to get health insurance because it was complicated. That constituted, when we passed the ACA, 18% of the population. The other aspect is that healthcare costs have been going up nearly 7% per year under the Bush administration from 2000 to 2009. And that rise in healthcare costs was putting a lot of pressure on families.
So let's talk about the first one. As you just mentioned, it was designed to increase access to health insurance coverage. It's largely done that. The uninsured rate has gone from about 15% in 2010 to about 8% in 2024. That's according to the most recent estimate that we have by the Centers for Disease Control. How did it accomplish that?
Well, one, many of your listeners will remember, we allowed young people to stay on their parents' insurance all the way up to age 26 while they were getting their first job. The second was we expanded Medicaid in conjunction with the states. We changed it from a program that only covered pregnant women or the disabled or the elderly who were poor to cover all poor people under 138% of the federal poverty line. And the third way is we established these exchanges for people who were working in middle-class jobs often who just couldn't get insurance for a variety of reasons. And we had an exchange where private insurers would offer policies that people could get. I would say there was a fourth thing, which is we got rid of the pre-existing disease exclusions.
Are there issues that you see now that you didn't see when you were first helping to craft the ACA? And is there anything that has emerged since then that you didn't anticipate?
Yes, I would say two major changes I would like to make in hindsight. One is the system's incredibly complicated. You can get insurance through Medicare. You can get insurance through Medicaid. You can get insurance through your employer. You can get insurance in the exchanges, in the VA, if you're a Native American, Indian Health Service, and on and on and on. That complication, frankly, the Affordable Care added to that complication by putting in the exchanges. The second, I think, big change that I would like to make is more standardization of the insurance products. We allowed these high deductible plans so that even people who have insurance are dissuaded from going to the doctor because they're worried about the cost. We have high copay so that, again, even if you're insured, you can actually be spending out-of-pocket expenses of thousands and thousands of dollars and go bankrupt. And by the way, there are some states that have really done that, like California in its exchange has really standardized the products that are offered. So it's a lot easier for people to compare products. And with more competition over the same kind of product, you should lower the costs.
Well, to that end, let's talk about the cost. The Congressional Budget Office estimates that these subsidies that we've been talking about, these tax credits, will cost about $350 billion over 10 years. And there are people like, I mean, for example, I'm saying Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson, who was on this program a couple of weeks ago, said, we just can't afford it. It's just too expensive. What do you say to that?
We are spending 17.5% of our GDP. We have a completely inefficient healthcare system. We can afford it. We spend more by $1.5 trillion than any other country on healthcare. We could afford it. We have way too much administrative costs, $1 trillion. So I think there's a lot we could do to actually streamline the system, save money, and use it to cover people. But the idea that some people should risk dying because we don't have $350 billion over 10 years, and Ron Johnson is voting for tax cuts for billionaires, that just doesn't compute. That's not a consistent policy.
Why is this such an intractable problem?
That has to do with how we've structured the system. The fact that the system is this complicated, as I mentioned, increases administrative costs to $1 trillion. Another problem is the way we pay doctors and hospitals and other people providing care, mainly by fee-for-service. That obviously creates an incentive to do more, even when that more is not the most efficient way to do it or totally necessary. We have variable costs. You know, there's not a single price for a stay in the hospital. There's a Medicare price, there's a Medicaid price, and every insurance company has multiple prices with that exact same hospital for that exact same procedure or overnight stay or whatever. Talk about creating all sorts of gaming opportunities for people to make money, even though they're not providing better care.
You once told my colleague Scott Simon, I think this was back in 2014, that while the Affordable Care Act isn't perfect, it's a, quote, pretty good structure to go forward, unquote. You still think so?
Yeah, it certainly accomplished a lot. It reduced the uninsured rate. It controlled costs. Now we need even more extensive reform to reform the health insurance system, to reform the delivery system and how we pay. Those things we couldn't get to without the Affordable Care Act being a step in the right direction, but it wasn't a finished product.
That is Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel. He's considered one of the architects of the Affordable Care Act. Dr. Emanuel, thanks so much for sharing these insights and recollections with us.
Well, this has been a wonderful interview, and I hope your audience has learned something about the benefits of the Affordable Care Act.
This is NPR News.
I'm Heidi Holton. We're excited at KEXE to be bringing you more jazz programming with our volunteer, Paul Kivi, the history of jazz.
Well, I think this is some of the finest music ever made, and it's kind of gotten lost across time. I pick the songs that I love, and there's lots of them, and there's lots to love. The popular music in the late 20s and 30s, especially the 30s and 40s with the big band era, that was jazz. That was the one period of time when jazz was popular music. And so you're going to hear a lot of things that are easy to get into. If you develop a taste for it, then the stuff that happens starting with Charlie Parker in the late 1940s makes sense.
Hear the history of jazz on KAXE with Paul Kivi, Saturdays at noon and Sundays at 4.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From Fidelity Investments, a dedicated advisor can help build a comprehensive wealth plan. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. From Luminescence Foundation. Luminescence Foundation is dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases and supporting land conservation initiatives. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. Most of Jamaica is without power and has limited phone service after the strongest hurricane to ever hit the island made landfall this week. At least 8 people have died there. NPR's Greg Allen reports people are eager to send aid from South Florida, home to the second largest Jamaican community in the U.S.
At a warehouse in Doral, a Miami suburb, volunteers have been working to pack boxes filled with food, water, and hygiene products that are being shipped to Jamaica by Global Empowerment Mission. Joe Bernal is one of the volunteers.
These necessity kits will usually feed a family of 4. They have all types of goodies, and hopefully these will be on an airplane heading towards Jamaica tomorrow morning.
Global Empowerment Mission has been active in the Caribbean and around the world since it was founded in response to the 2010 Haiti earthquake. The charity says it has more than a dozen tractor-trailer-sized containers loaded with aid already on their way to Jamaica. One volunteer packing and taping up boxes was Dana Levy. She was born and raised in Jamaica and says her family members in the Kingston area came through the storm okay. She says they were worried, though, about Melissa's winds, 185 miles per hour at landfall.
The most powerful one before this was Gilbert in 1988. So people are feeling it right now, but they're happy to see that we're here packing goods to send back to Jamaica.
Despite its nearly unprecedented strength, Melissa was a relatively small hurricane that focused its destructive power on the island's western side. Raj Miraj, another volunteer, says his family and friends in the east in Kingston were all fine and remarkably upbeat.
It's the island, so there's always, I would say, a more positive attitude that, okay, everything's going to be fine. Let's not worry too much. But when the forecasters were predicting the amount of rain, the amount of winds, put that together with a very fragile infrastructure, very, very difficult situation.
Suddenly, one volunteer rings a bell while others cheer. They just completed a pallet of 50 boxes. Not everyone was in the mood to celebrate. Adrian Long was worried about his relatives, who live near where Hurricane Melissa made landfall.
I have a lot of family there. My mom was born and raised in Southfield, St. Elizabeth, west of Black River, where the eye hit. I haven't heard from anybody. No power. Everything is probably gone.
Long says he came to pack aid boxes to do what he could to, in his words, serve his people. Greg Allen, NPR News, Doral, Florida.
Voters in California will decide on Tuesday whether to support Governor Gavin Newsom's redistricting plan intended to counter Republican efforts in Texas and other red states. Congressman Dave Valadejo of the Central Valley is one of 5 at-risk Republicans if Proposition 50 passes, and that worries some farmers in his district. Here's Kerry Klein with member station KVPR.
Charles Meyer grows a cornucopia of crops on his 1,500 acres in Stratford in Kings County, California.
We're growing wheat. We're growing alfalfa. We're growing almonds. We're growing pistachios.
But this third-generation farmer has a clear favorite. He plucks a white puffball off a short brown stalk.
This is Pima cotton. Normally they have three locks. See, there's one, two, three. Regular cotton usually has five locks and they're bigger bowls, but this is very high quality fiber.
Kings County is one of three agricultural counties that make up District 22, represented by Republican Congressman David Valadao. Dairy farms, vineyards, and tidy rows of tomatoes bring in billions of dollars a year here and provide tens of thousands of jobs. It's a point of pride for Meyer.
You become attached to the ground. It's like our boys in the military. They give their life for the country. We feel about our ground about like that.
Meyer wants elected leaders who feel that way too, like Valadao, who used to be a dairy farmer. He was first elected to Congress in 2012, but he's in danger of losing his seat. If voters approve Prop 50 next month, District 22 would stretch out almost twice as long in order to gain Democratic voters from neighboring counties and give Democrats a better shot at winning. And Meyer does not support that.
I don't want anything that would help Democrats gain power.
That's because California Democrats have pushed a slew of environmental regulations aimed at protecting air, water, and ecosystems. They also restrict things like groundwater and fertilizer use. Meyer calls that regulatory overreach, and he blames Democrats for rising farming costs and slumping profits.
When they gain power, negative things happen.
It's a common opinion. Signs reading "Vote No on Prop 50" line Kings County's highways, alongside banners to recall Democratic Governor Newsom. A few miles away, in Hanford, Doug Verboon doesn't like Prop 50 either. He's a farmer harvesting walnuts.
So that was a gondola unloading walnuts into an elevator, putting it into an 18-wheeler to take it to the walnut processing plant.
Verboon is also a county supervisor and a Republican. He and other supervisors have formally opposed partisan redistricting that would change district maps through the next three election cycles. They say it unfairly bypasses the independent state commission that draws district lines.
We do it every 10 years, and we have a process in place that works.
He says gerrymandering isn't just about who controls the House. He says Congress matters here. The feds pass laws that can influence exports, trade decisions, and water flows that determine farmer incomes.
We want our congressmen and our senators to promote agriculture in Central California. And when it comes to our congressmen, we need someone that understands it that doesn't have to have it explained to them.
But many Democrats, however, support the new map, like Carla Orozco. She's a retired science teacher holding up a sign in nearby Lemoore.
My sign says, yes, I'm Prop 50, temporary maps.
It's a bright Friday morning. Orozco is part of a, quote, bridge brigade that hangs signs on overpasses throughout Kings County. None of the dozen volunteers here today are farmers. They're angry that Valadao hasn't hosted an in-person town hall in more than a year, and that he voted to cut Medicaid, even though he said he wouldn't, and two-thirds of his constituents rely on it.
And that's going to hurt a lot of people, and it's going to wake a lot of people up when the health care premiums go up.
She hopes voters will come out and do the right thing in the election next month. There's just no clear consensus here on what the right thing is. For NPR News, I'm Carrie Klein in Kings County, California.
This is NPR News.
Toads have taken over the world. The amphibians originated in South America, but they found their way to six continents. So what gave toads the edge?
They're highly toxic now. They have these big parotid glands on their necks. And that is actually an anti-predator device.
I'm Scott Detrow. More secrets behind toads' global domination on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered starting at 4 o'clock this afternoon with your local host, Andrew DeZingle. Good morning. It is 529. Thanks for listening to the Thursday morning show on KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a few moments, our daily dose of phenology. John Latimer will look back at his nature notes for this date, October 30th.
Weather for today, mostly cloudy, highs near 46, light southwest winds. Lows tonight in the low to mid 30s. And for tomorrow, slight chance of rain, cloudy with highs in the mid 40s. Looking ahead to Saturday, we are looking at mostly cloudy skies, highs in the low 40s. It is Member Appreciation Week here at KAXC. We are so filled with gratitude for the community that has kept us going during the loss of federal funding. Today we will be at Jack Pine Brewery in Baxter from 4 to 6. You can chat with KAXC staff and other members while enjoying a pint. And we invite you to stop into either of our studios, KAXC in Grand Rapids, KBXC in Bemidji, tomorrow during business hours for trick-or-treating. We'll be handing out candy to both young and old. Also on Saturday, we have a special Kids Green Cheese from 6 to 7 with Mike Spry and youngsters Mia and Alex. And that's followed by our regular Green Cheese Trivia Program 7 to 9 with Brandon Chase. And KAXC is proud to bring you a new podcast. The Season Watch Pod features hosts Charlie Mitchell, Heidi Holton, John Latimer, and a cast of characters. It's a podcast for the curious, filled with the delights of nature. New episodes come out Thursday mornings. That would be today at 8 o'clock. Brainerd Community Theater presents Dracula, a comedy of terrors, tonight through Saturday at the Chalberg Theater on the campus of Central Lakes College in Brainerd. Find more information at clcperformingarts.com.
On today's date, October 30th in the year 2012, I have a note saying that I have seen my last tussock moth caterpillar. Last? Not really. It turns out that the tussock moth, like the woolly bear caterpillar, is one of those caterpillars that can be active throughout the winter. The tussock moth it's a family of moths, and they're quite varied in their appearances, but the caterpillars all have a similar way of avoiding being eaten, and that is they are very hairy, much like the woolly bear caterpillar. The tussock moth is very hairy, but the tussock moth is usually yellow with a black stripe. Sometimes it's got these red tufts of hair. Sometimes it's got four or five little columns, very tight packed columns of hair right in the middle of its back. So the tussock moths are quite easily identified, a little bit unusual in their appearance. But if you are seeing a caterpillar walking around in the middle of winter, and I have seen them in just about every month, maybe not in January, but certainly in March and April and in obviously October and November, they still are active. They have some way of protecting themselves against freezing, and when the weather warms up, they get out and move about. So watch out. Maybe you'll see a tussock moth. If not today, perhaps later on this winter.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From The Economist, in a world of rapid change, The Economist seeks to cut through the noise to offer insight into what matters now and what's coming next. Daily global reporting, podcasts, videos, and more at economist.com. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C. More than 65,000 infants, toddlers, and preschoolers may soon be at risk of losing access to Head Start.
That's the federal program that provides child care and early learning for low-income families. And because of the government shutdown, a wave of local Head Start centers across the U.S. could be forced to close beginning November 1st.
For more, we're joined by NPR's Corey Turner. Good morning, Cordy.
Good morning, Layla.
So 65,000 children. I mean, help us understand why this is happening.
Yeah, so local Head Start programs all over the country run on different federal funding cycles. And the National Head Start Association says 134 of these programs are supposed to be getting their next round of federal funding November 1st. They can't do that if the government is still shut down. And so without those federal dollars, these centers are now rushing to find alternative funding. Here's Tommy Sheridan of the National Head Start Association.
They are scrambling and trying to figure out how long they can keep the doors open. There is a ton of hard work, a ton of goodwill, a ton of dedication, but hard work, goodwill, and dedication don't keep your doors open.
For now, Layla, these unfunded programs serve nearly 1 in 10 children in Head Start. And if they have to close, many working families may have to choose between taking care of their kids and going to work.
Is there anything these communities can do short of waiting for the shutdown to end?
I mean, for many programs, the answer is a pretty clear no. They are going to have to close after Friday. Some may be able to stay open at least a little longer. A year ago, I spent some time in Michigan's remote Upper Peninsula, where Corey Holcomb runs a Head Start program, and it turns out it is one of these places that is going to run out of money in early November. Holcomb told me her agency and board of directors have found a way to keep the doors open two more weeks. Here's how.
Making use of some reserve funds, pulling in other resources with the hopes that we will be reimbursed. And we've asked for deferments on rent payments and some utility bills during that time to still provide services.
And I should say, Layla, by services, Holcomb doesn't just mean childcare. Head Start provides high-quality early learning backed by research, plus free health screening, care for kids with disabilities, not to mention multiple nutritious meals every day, which is extra important right now, with federal food benefits for low-income families also set to expire at the exact same time.
Wow. So, Corey, do we know where these closures might hit hardest?
Yeah, according to a map put together by the National Head Start Association, programs will be at risk in more than 40 states, but the places hit hardest first will likely be Florida, Georgia, Missouri, and Ohio. Keep in mind, though, Head Start serves about 750,000 children, and if this shutdown keeps going, more and more of those centers are gonna run out of money. It's also worth stepping back here for a quick second, Layla, because Head Start celebrated its 60th anniversary this year. And while it still enjoys strong bipartisan support, the Trump administration actually considered trying to cut the program from its budget proposal. And in the spring, they temporarily withheld funding from Head Start. So this shutdown is just the latest crisis in what's been a pretty tough year for Head Start and the families who depend on it.
NPR education correspondent Corey Turner. Thank you, Corey.
You're welcome.
President Trump's pick for Surgeon General will have her confirmation hearing.
Later this morning, Dr. Casey Means will appear in front of a Senate committee. It's been more than 5 months since Trump announced Means would replace his initial choice, who was a Fox News contributor. Means is a wellness influencer, entrepreneur, and author.
NPR's Will Stone joins us now to talk about her nomination. So, Will, what will you be looking for in this confirmation hearing for Surgeon General?
Well, this is a somewhat unusual hearing because it will be held virtually. Casey Means will join remotely. And we do know she's pregnant. Actually, her brother, who is a close advisor to Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., shared that back in May. So I'm expecting she will be grilled about her qualifications and potential conflicts of interest. Means recently said, if confirmed, she would resign from her company that promotes continuous glucose monitors. And she also disclosed other financial ties, including to the supplement industry.
Okay, so tell us about Casey Means' medical resume.
Yeah, Means is in her late 30s. She went to Stanford Medical School and was pretty far along in her training to be a head and neck surgeon, but she dropped out of residency before finishing. Then she pivoted to what's known as functional medicine, briefly had a practice in Oregon, but really made her name on social media and through a book she published with her brother on diet and metabolic health. They did the rounds on big podcasts in the wellness space. And her message tends to echo, you know, what you hear from Kennedy and his allies in the Make America Healthy Again movement, especially when they talk about the high rates of chronic illness. Here's how she talked about that at a congressional roundtable led by Republicans last year.
What we are dealing with here is so much more than a physical health crisis. This is a spiritual crisis.
Means often talks about our food supply, environmental toxins. She criticizes the reliance on the pharmaceutical industry. And Kennedy has said she will be, quote, the greatest surgeon general ever.
Now, Will, I've heard that there has been a little bit of pushback to Casey Means.
That's right. On several fronts, certainly a lot of pushback from folks in the medical and public health establishment pointing to what they say is her lack of qualifications. She doesn't have the leadership or clinical experience you'd expect from the Surgeon General, who is considered the nation's top doctor. Dr. Jerome Adams, who was Surgeon General during Trump's first term, told me confirming Means would set a, quote, disastrous precedent for the nation's top public health role. And she has made statements casting doubt on the safety of the childhood vaccine schedule, also about oral contraceptives. She's endorsed raw milk, similar to Kennedy. Now, interestingly, when Trump announced he'd pick Means, you also saw some opposition emerge from some supporters of Kennedy. And part of that was some in that camp seemed to worry she wasn't critical enough of vaccines. So there were questions about whether this fracture in the MAHA base would sink her confirmation. I asked David Mansdorfer about this. He's a consultant and was Deputy Assistant Secretary for the Department of Health and Human Services during Trump's first term.
To me, there's nothing substantive in the opposition that I think will cause any sort of significant impediment for her being appointed.
Mansdorfer says it takes a lot to get these hearings set up, and the Trump administration would not be scheduling this now if they thought, you know, she did not have the votes to get confirmed.
All right, that's NPR's Will Stone. Well, thanks.
Thank you.
This afternoon in All Things Considered, the latest story in their healthcare helpline series answering your questions about navigating the health system. One listener recently found out her regular doctors were no longer in her insurance network, so her insurer would not pay. So is there anything she can do to keep her family's doctors? Listen in the NPR app, on a smart speaker, or on this reliable public radio station. This is NPR News.
KEXE was first on the air in 1976. Recently, a couple of the founders, Rich and Susie McClear, stopped by to talk about why KEXE was needed then.
A lot of people were up here thinking they were doing their own thing. And when the radio station came on the air, they found a neighbor was doing the same thing, or somebody across town, and it magically became a, there are a lot of us up here that have the same thoughts, the same activities.
Neighbors talking to neighbors. We help them get in contact with each other and talk to each other about common problems.
KEXE is still needed now. We're connected through green cheese trivia, through great music and events. We're in crisis mode. We have had all of our funding cut from the federal government. Please help us out. You can text the word donate to 218-326-1234. I'm Heidi Holton. Thank you so much for your support.
Turn your radio on. Turn your radio on. Turn your radio on. Turn your radio on.
Good morning. It is 5:42. Thanks for listening to the Thursday morning show on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 6:20, our early bird fishing guide, Jeff Sundin. And at 7:45, we'll talk with our news director, Chelsea Perkins. We'll hear about some of the stories our news team has been working on. She'll also tell us about an event happening in Baxter this afternoon as part of our Member Appreciation Week. It is Clink and Drink. Again, that is 4 to 6 today at Jack Pine Brewery in Baxter. You can meet Chelsea and some other staff and other members of KAXE.
Mostly cloudy today, highs near 46, light southwest winds. Our lows tonight in the low to mid 30s. And tomorrow, slight chance of rain, cloudy, highs in the mid 40s. Looking ahead to Saturday, cloudy with highs in the low 40s. You can answer our question of the week. We want to hear about your favorite Halloween costumes of the past. Send photos if you have them. And you can also tell us about your favorite or not so favorite candy. Text us 218-326-1234. The Crow Wing County Sheriff's Office has a trunk or treat tomorrow from 3:30 to 5:30 in the county parking lot on the corner of Laurel and 4th Street in Brainerd. Kids can trick or treat while checking out various police cars and the K-9 team. Let us know what's happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxc.org.
R comes from this station and from BritBox, committed to helping viewers to see it differently with British TV. With new original series like Code of Silence, about a deaf woman recruited as a lip reader in a high-stakes police investigation. Streaming at BritBox.com. From CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez. The White House fired all six members of the U.S. Commission of Fine Arts this week. The independent federal agency advises the president and Congress on design plans for monuments, memorials, coins, and federal buildings, including projects such as the anticipated $300 million White House ballroom. The administration tells NPR it plans to appoint new members who are, quote, more aligned with President Trump's America First policies. Bruce Redman Becker is an architect and developer. He was appointed to the commission in 2024 and was one of the six members who was fired. Bruce, did you think that this was coming, considering the results of the election?
No, it came as a surprise. Historically, the commissioners serve at least four-year terms, and they actually continue on until they're successors are appointed. So, yeah, no, we were caught off guard and didn't expect this.
Considering that President Joe Biden fired the members who have been appointed in President Trump's first term, I kind of thought that maybe you were expecting this, but you say no.
There were three that continued on into the next administration.
So what makes the responsibilities of this group important?
Well, we're sort of the guardians of design quality in Washington, D.C., both for public buildings and for private buildings. You know, we're volunteers. We meet monthly, and design teams present their projects to us. They're, you know, can range from a memorial for fallen journalists, which we reviewed long ago, to the addition to the Air and Space Museum, to smaller projects and military cemeteries. And, you know, the interesting thing that creates value is we have a lot of talented experience, seven members, some of whom are architects, landscape architects, planners. We look at it, and generally all of our comments are welcomed. It's just an advisory role. So we're there to provide coaching and quality control. And I think over the, 115 years since we were federally chartered, there's general agreement that our advice and service have led to a more beautiful capital for our nation.
And at its core, the organization is nonpartisan.
Yeah, no, typically they're appointees from different parties that overlap. And part of the value of the CFA is the diversity of viewpoints. And, generally when we're looking at projects, you art and architecture from different perspectives, there's a general consensus about whether the quality of something is good or not, or how it can be improved. And it's not political.
So just because this group, or the fired group, was appointed by President Biden, that wouldn't have necessarily meant that you wouldn't have approved the proposed ballroom project of President Trump.
Well, you know, we actually don't have control to stop something or to issue a stop work order. We just are there to coach and advise and ask questions to make sure whatever is being done doesn't cut corners in terms of its scale and its quality and materiality. I think we would have had plenty to say about it, but we wouldn't be stop it. You know, we're providing voluntary advice that can be ignored.
All right, that's Bruce Redman Becker, architect and developer. He recently served in the U.S. Commission of Fine Arts. Bruce, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin.
Green Cheese listeners know how important it is to support stations like KAXE KBXE.
Anyone who can, be sure to donate, because as all of us know, they listen to this, Green Cheese and all the other programming on the stations, we really, really love it and don't want anything to happen to it. So it's really important to give what you can.
One thing I wanted to do is I wanted to talk to everybody out there. Radio is important when it's unique and it's interesting and it's local, and given your current funding situation, everybody out there should be doing something about that, no matter how little it is. If everybody did something, it makes a tremendous difference. Think about Saturday nights with no green cheese. That sounds terrible.
It would be so boring.
This is the queen, and I'm going to make an edict. All cheeses, get your checkbooks out and send in some money to our favorite station and show, and my check will be in the mail tomorrow.
Donate now at KAXE.org.
This morning's business news includes food stamps, interest rates, and rent freezes.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on thinkorswim. More at schwab.com.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. It's now 30 days of government shutdown. It is now likely that most of the 42 million people on food stamps or SNAP will not get their November benefits starting this weekend. I say most, with some states trying to find ways to fill the gap. When or if the government reopens, the delayed money would come. Now, we've been reporting on how this hits vulnerable families and food banks nationwide, which are already coping with a spike in demand. As Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports here, the abrupt loss of SNAP dollars will also hurt stores that accept food stamps, actually EBT cards in practice.
Every month, the federal government spends about $8 billion on SNAP benefits. The millions of people who get those benefits then spend them at businesses, often in their communities.
This is a really important, invisible piece of the economy.
Lily Roberts at the Center for American Progress says it's not just people who qualify for those benefits who rely on them.
There are stores in neighborhoods that have more than 50% of their sales from SNAP. Those are stores that are typically in lower income areas or that are in rural areas.
If benefits just stop, Stephanie Johnson at the National Grocers Association says it will be a big deal for those stores, especially small independent ones.
Grocer staffing and inventory are planned around SNAP benefits. So a lapse could lead to reduced employee hours, losses in perishable food items, and declining sales.
She says SNAP supports nearly 400,000 jobs in the U.S. and helps generate about $20 billion in wages and over $4 billion in taxes. Elaine Waxman at the Urban Institute says it acts as a form of stimulus, especially during economic slowdowns.
We sometimes talk about SNAP as if it's a cost and a drain on the economy, but it's actually an important component of the way that we not only assure that people can have enough food to eat, but that the businesses in the food sector have a regular flow of income.
Every dollar the government spends on SNAP generates over $1.50 in economic activity. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Markets predicted it, and it happened. The Federal Reserve lowered interest rates yesterday by a quarter of a percentage point, with the job market losing steam. But Fed Chair Jerome Powell made no promises about more cuts this year. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that.
Fed Chair Jerome Powell set the tone in his opening statement at yesterday's press conference, even before he started taking questions. He said a rate cut in December
is not a foregone conclusion. Far from it.
In fact, Powell said there are strongly differing views about what to do at the next meeting. Part of the problem is the federal government isn't producing economic data right now because of the shutdown. Powell said there's a growing chorus of central bank officials who think the Fed should wait before lowering rates again. The division at the Fed is clear. There were two dissents at this week's meeting. One dissenter wanted even lower rates. The other didn't want a rate cut at all. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Marketplace's China correspondent is also covering the agreement today between the U.S. president and the China president for a one-year trade truce that rolls back some tariffs and other restrictions. That coverage will be in the Marketplace Morning Podcast later if you miss it on the air. Markets, S&P and NASDAQ futures are each down 0.1%.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Yubico, makers of the YubiKey. YubiKey helps protect important digital applications and services. YubiKey, still undefeated, the original passkey. More at yubico.com. And by MarketWatch. From housing prices to inflation, the market is uncertain. MarketWatch has tools to help navigate the road ahead. MarketWatch, don't short yourself.
Early voting is underway to choose New York City's next mayor. The apparent frontrunner, Zohran Mamdani, has made a rent freeze for 1 million rent-subsidized apartments his signature issue. His opponents, former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo and Guardian Angels founder Curtis Sliwa, say that's a bad idea. Freezing rent does have a recent track record in New York. Marketplace's Carla Javier has that.
In New York City, the mayor appoints members of the Rent Guidelines Board. And every year, the RGB decides how much rents on stabilized units increase. Former Chair Rachel Godsell explained the board's balancing act at a June 2015 meeting.
The purpose of the law and the role of the RGB are to protect tenants from excessively high rents while also ensuring that owners can pay for necessary costs and receive a fair return on their investment.
That year, the balance the RGB struck was a 0% rent increase. The next year, it extended the freeze. Oksana Mironova is a senior policy analyst with the Community Service Society of New York. Her organization surveys low-income New Yorkers.
Usually there's about like 25 to 30% of people who fall behind on the rent.
But she says during the freeze,
you actually saw that particular hardship drop by about 8 or 9 points and other hardships as well.
Tenants reported fewer utility shutoffs and eviction threats, Mironova says. But landlords of rent-stabilized units found the freeze challenging, according to Small Property Owners of New York board president Ann Korchak. She points to RGB data from 2017, showing they faced increased costs for insurance, taxes, labor.
Operating expenses increased over 6% and 4.5% in 2018. So those rent freezes meant that, you know, rent was not keeping up.
Korchak co-owns two buildings that include rent-stabilized units. She says that buildings like hers are old and needed repairs during the freeze.
If you don't have enough revenue to keep up with your expenses, you know, you often are now delaying a repair.
The RGB froze rents again early in the pandemic, but the nationwide eviction moratorium and assistance programs make it hard to draw lessons from that freeze. Since then, the board has approved increases of between 1.5% and 3.25% annually. Elsewhere in the country, freezes are relatively rare, says Edward Goetz at the University of Minnesota. But rent regulation may be gaining steam. St. Paul, Minnesota put it in place.
And you have it on the ballot in places across the country, in the Midwest and other eastern cities where it hadn't been on the agenda before.
Goetz says those jurisdictions will be watching how New York balances the needs of tenants and landlords going forward. I'm Carla Javier from Marketplace.
And economic insecurity is keeping people from eating at Chipotle, which tends to cater to more middle-class diners. While profits met expectations yesterday, Chipotle expects even fewer people will come in the fall. The stock is down 18% in pre-market trading now. In Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio, Marketplace Morning Report from APM, American Public Media.
It's a minute before 6 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXC Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXC Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at KAXC.org. This week, it's Member Appreciation Week, and we're taking time to thank you for keeping us powered, keeping us going, especially after the loss of federal funding this summer. We couldn't be here without you. Coming up at 6:20, our early bird fishing guide, Jeff Sundin. Mostly cloudy today, highs near 46, light southwest winds. Lows tonight in the low to mid 30s, and tomorrow, slight chance of rain, cloudy, highs in the mid 40s. Support comes from Minnesota Power, an elite company envisioning a carbon-free future through their Energy Forward strategy. More at mnpower.com/energyforward. More news is next on KAXC.